Supporters and opponents of the Tunisian president gather outside the parliament following his decision to freeze the parliament and dismiss the government. A top U.S. general says American forces will continue their airstrikes in support of the Afghan military fighting the Taliban. The top U.S. infectious disease official says his country is headed in the wrong direction in dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. But starting with Tunisia, Parliament Speaker, they're urging people to take to the streets to end what he's calling a coup d'etat by President Kais Saied. Rachid Ghannouchi's call came after the president dismissed Prime Minister Hichem Mechichi and suspended the legislature. Ghannouchi has also led a sit-in in front of parliament after the army blocked him from entering the legislature building following the president's decision. Meantime, supporters of the Ennahda party, that's headed by Ghannouchi, faced off against Saied supporters near the parliament premises. The political crisis follows violent protests in several cities across the African nation. Demonstrations were held over the government's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic and the economy. Abayomi Ezekiwa, an editor with the Pan-African Newswire, says that protests in Tunisia have been provoked by a dire economic situation, which is the result of the COVID pandemic.
First of all, economic situation that is dire. Tunisia was heavily dependent upon tourism, and since the COVID-19 pandemic has had a tremendous impact on Europe during 2020 and even in 2021, this has cut back tremendously on the amount of foreign exchange that they have access to. The Ennahda party, which is a moderate Islamist party, has the largest number of deputies within the parliament. And Rashid Ghannouchi is the head and speaker of the party. So they are, in fact, against what President Kais Saied is doing. Saied has more of a secular background, academic background, and at the same time, he was supported by the Ennahda party, but he also had a lot of support among young people inside the country as well. So I think the president is attempting to quell the demonstrations by firing the prime minister, Mechichi, and also suspending the parliament.
Okay, now moving on, let's take a look at Lebanon. Now, a group of former prime minister, Lebanese prime ministers, say that they have chosen ex-premier Najib Mikati to form a new government. The group of top Sunni leaders issued a statement after they met in Beirut. Among them was Saad Hariri, who stepped down as prime minister-designate last week. Hariri did so after he failed to form a government, citing differences with President Michel Aoun. On Monday, Aoun is due to meet with parliamentary blocs for talks on naming a new prime minister. Lebanon has been run by a caretaker administration since August last year. And that's when the government resigned in the aftermath of a devastating explosion in the Beirut port. The political crisis in Lebanon has exacerbated the economic problems there, too. Now, Hamas has slammed the recent Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip and stressed that the resistance is ready for all possible options. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassam noted that the aggression was Tel Aviv's failed attempt to restore its tarnished image following the recent Israel-Gaza escalation. Now, those remarks came after Israeli aircraft performed attacks on the Gaza Strip, targeting areas in Gaza City and Khan Yunis. The strikes mainly hit open areas and farmland and caused no injury. The Israeli military claims the attack was in response to incendiary balloons launched from the coastal enclave. Now, in our news review program, we've discussed the latest Israeli crimes against Palestinians.
For more on that, we're joined by Ahmed Al-Toni. He's the co-chair at the Green Party from New Jersey. And we also have Ken O'Keefe, a human rights activist from Orlando. Gentlemen, welcome. Ahmed, if I can start with you, you know, you've got these balloons that are flying from the Gaza Strip, essentially hitting Israeli settlements. Gaza is the world's largest open-air prison, and they're balloons, they're hitting settlements, causing not much damage. The settlements that belonged to the people that are now in Gaza, the world's largest open-air prison. In response, you got Israeli warplanes bombing the place, bombing Gaza Strip. Where's the justice in that?
There is absolutely no justice at all, zero justice. This is continued criminal behavior by Israel. Israel largely behaves like a rogue state because there are no ramifications for its actions. But this is, in addition to the bombings, just the closing of the fishing waters and reducing the fishing zone. This is part of the Israeli attempt to ethnically cleanse Palestinians. And I'll tell you something. I actually just came today from a BDS action in the New York port where we were trying to prevent the unloading of an Israeli ship. And I said this exact thing over there. The United Nations defines genocide by doing one of five acts, just one of these five. Israel has committed all five. And this is an example of one of them, which is to deliberately set conditions that are meant to cause physical destruction upon a group. And when you look at Gaza, like you said, it's an open-air prison, the largest open-air prison in the world. It's about the size of Brooklyn. It doesn't get much rainfall, maybe 15 inches a year or something like that. And they're taking away its fishing. Their whole objective since the creation of Israel, since the creation of Zionism, Zionists have wanted as much Palestinian land as possible with as little Palestinians as possible. And this is just a continued effort from those policies.
So, Ken, the fishing zone has been reduced to 6 nautical miles. I believe at one stage it was supposed to be 30, so along those lines, 30 nautical miles as part of some treaty that's been obviously thrown in the dustbin. How is that going to affect the Palestinians' livelihoods?
When I was in after arriving with boats, I captained boats into Gaza, and in truth, the fishermen, they would fish. And I was, I volunteered to go out with them because they felt emboldened to go out past the 3-mile limit, which they can't get into the deep enough water to be able to get the fish that would really give them a reasonable opportunity to feed their population. They are very much a fishing culture. So we did, and we went out further than they had done for years, because if they go out past the limit, they'll be shot at and die and lose their boat and their livelihood and their ability to feed their family, everything. So we did. We went out, and they all said, thank you. And also, they had the biggest catch ever they had, because they could get out into deep enough water to catch the fish. So in answer to your question, the impact on the Palestinians is genocide by the legal, lawful definition of the word in Black's Law Dictionary, to destroy in whole or part. The intention is to genocide them. And also, I feel obligated to always say, prisons, if you're in a prison, it's because you committed a crime. And there's all different types of people, but you've all committed a crime, or at least have been accused of a crime. A concentration camp would be a more accurate description, because the concentration camp has Palestinians. That's it. That's your qualification. Palestinian, get in there. It's so different from what they accused Adolf Hitler of doing in World War II. Concentration camps. You're a Jew and you're a gypsy, get in the concentration camp. So I do believe, I know grammatically I'm correct here, it's a concentration camp. It's Gaza concentration camp is what it is.
Thank you very much indeed. Let me thank our guests, Ahmed Al-Toni. He's the co-chair of the Green Party, joining us from New Jersey. We also had Ken O'Keefe, human rights activist, joining us from Orlando. And that brings an end to the news review for this hour.
Now, moving on, the head of the U.S. Army Central Command saying that American forces will continue their air raids in support of the Afghan military fighting the Taliban.
President Biden has set a date of 31 August for the cessation of our campaign here. After that date, we will still provide significant logistics support to the Afghan military. We will still provide significant logistics support, in particular, to the Afghan Air Force through maintenance here on the ground, as well as maintenance at advanced bases in the central command theater. So all of those things will continue. So we will continue to support the Afghan forces even after that 31 August date. It will generally be from over the horizon. That will be a significant honor.
General McKenzie also acknowledged that there are tough days ahead for the Afghan government, saying it will be clear in the next days and weeks if Afghan forces will be able to defend their country. Now, those comments came as thousands of families are displaced in the fighting in the past month in the southern city of Kandahar. On Sunday, fighting continued, and McKenzie said that the U.S. Air Force carried out airstrikes in the province. Ousted from power in a U.S.-led invasion in 2001, the Taliban have spearheaded deadly fighting, taking dozens of cities and villages. Government forces have launched operations to retake strategic areas from the militant group. A ranking Chinese diplomat has urged the U.S. to stop demonizing Beijing and blaming it for its own structural problems. China's Vice Foreign Minister Xi Feng made the comment during a meeting with U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman in the Chinese city of Tianjin. Feng said that some people in the U.S. view China as an imaginary enemy. He said this is the main cause of tensions between the two countries. Sherman arrived in Tianjin on Sunday for the second diplomatic meeting between Washington and Beijing under President Biden's administration. The first meeting in March ended without any progress. Beijing-Washington relations have deteriorated ever since, with a series of tit-for-tat sanctions and diplomatic barbs. The political commentator Fabrizio Goldoni says it's the U.S. strategy to create enemies to push forward its hybrid warfare across the world.
We have to put in context the point that demonizing China, they help in internal affairs because they are creating an enemy, okay? So basically, they already created two enemies. They create Russia first as enemy, and now they reinforce the creation of a second enemy, that is China. This is very important for their purpose of following an hybrid warfare.
A top U.S. infectious disease official, Anthony Fauci, has warned that the United States is heading in the wrong direction in dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. Fauci says that the U.S. is in an unnecessary, difficult situation due to increasing cases of infection. The doctor is saying that a hike is being fueled by unvaccinated Americans and the spread of the Delta variant of the virus. The expert says that the government may ask those vaccinated to wear masks and recommend that booster shots might be needed. More than 163 million people, that's 49% of the total U.S. population, are fully vaccinated. However, infections are soaring, especially in states with lower vaccination rates. Florida, Texas, and Missouri account for 40% of all new cases nationwide. Now, 7 years ago, Nigerian soldiers raided a peaceful demonstration in the northern city of Zaria. The assault marked the beginning of a deadly campaign that the army launched against members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and their leader, Sheikh Ezekiel. Hundreds of people were killed, hundreds more, including the Sheikh himself, sent to jail without any charge. But supporters and movements have not stopped demanding justice to this day. We have a report.
On July 25, 2014, Nigerian soldiers attacked in an international Kutz Day rally in the northern city of Zaria by opening fire at people holding a peaceful demonstration. At least 32 people were killed in the attack and many more were injured. The rally was organized by the Islamic movement in Nigeria, led by the prominent scholar Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Sheikh Zakzaki has been an outspoken critic of the Nigerian government and its relations with Israel. He lost three of his sons following the attack. One was shot during the rally, and the other two were arrested and later killed by the army along with other detainees. The day following the attack, three truckloads of soldiers went to the Hosseiniya Baqiyatullah, the headquarters of the Islamic movement, and carried out yet another assault. Nigerian soldiers raided a place and bombed the mosque. Three people were killed and dozens of others were wounded. Sheikh Zakzaki asked people to remain calm and called on the government to investigate the incident and bring those responsible to justice. But instead, another bloodbath took place. In December 2015, Nigerian soldiers attacked a religious ceremony organized by the IMN. The army claimed that they had responded to an attempt to assassinate Nigerian chief of army staff. The movement roundly denied such allegations. One day later, the army, using machine guns and tanks, attacked the movement's headquarters as well as the homes of members of the IMN. The extrajudicial killing left over 1,000 people dead.
They inhumanely massacred over 1,000 innocent people, among them 297 women, 23 of them pregnant.
Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife were shot and injured during the crackdown. They were taken into a custody instead of a hospital. Nigerian authorities claimed that they had detained a cleric to protect him from violence. The government later outlawed the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Many members of the IMN believe that all these attacks against their movement have been pre-planned.
Past 20 years, these people had been planning more attacks on the Islamic movement.
Since the attack, Sheikh Zakzaki has been in jail without any charge or trial. The imprisonment is despite a court ruling in 2016 ordering his release. Members of his family said that Sheikh Zakzaki's health condition continues to deteriorate in detention.
Their health continues to deteriorate as they were terribly injured during the massacre. And that has also continuously to be neglected by the government, which has led to the Sheikh having multiple strokes, and Malama could barely walk due to her ailing conditions.
Several human rights groups have expressed concern about Zakzaki's health situation and have called on the international community to intervene. They say the continued detention of the cleric and his wife without any charge violates all acceptable human rights standards. Even though there have been massive protests across Nigeria and the world calling for the release of Sheikh Zakzaki, the religious leader is still in detention. His followers, however, are not standing idly by and have vowed to continue pressing their demand for justice and the release of their leader.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
how hot it is. I'd better close the window and turn on the air conditioner. If you happen to decide to make an exciting trip, where would you travel? A cold, snowy mountain? The sea with a crowded beach? Or a green forest with a roaring river? All these destinations are good options for making an exciting trip, but I have a better choice. Let's make a trip to one of the hottest regions of the world, to Shahda Desert at the heart of Iran. Shahdad is a city located 78 kilometers from Kerman City. Northeast of the city of Shahdad, there is Shahdad Desert along with its kaluts. Kaluts are hills formed by wind or water erosion. The kaluts of Shahdad are the biggest and most unique kaluts of Iran, which are rarely seen anywhere in the world. Among the must-seen marvels of this region are egg-shaped forms created in salty ground. Other astonishing marvels of Shahdad Desert are vase-shaped sand dunes formed around vegetation called nebka. Nebka is a plant hill formed when sand has gathered under the foot of plants, and eventually there would form a hill of sand with a plant crown on it. The height of each single nebka as the highest desert vase-shaped sand dune reach about 10 meters and is considered as the rare flora of Shahdad Desert. I am now at the heart of Shahdad Desert, one of the most astonishing and beautiful natural attractions of Iran and the world. Here is one of the hottest regions of the world, and of course, a spectacular sight to visit. Oh, how calm it is here! The only sound you hear is the wind singing. I have come here to visit the kaluts of Shahdad. Oh my God, what a stunning scenery! The kaluts have created a fantastic atmosphere, as if it's a dreamy trip. While large kaluts are formed by water and wind erosion, the small ones are only shaped by wind. Beside Shahdad Desert Lake. This lake is called Javan. Actually, the existence of this lake at the heart of the desert is like a miracle.
This natural lake was formed after flooding in the desert in April 2019. After the formation of Javan Lake, migratory birds have come to the lake for food and rest. However, it's really hot now and I don't see any bird here. Oh my god, it's really hot in here. I have to come back to my desert eco lodge. I will be back here at night for watching the stars. Watching the dazzling starry sky of Shahdo Desert at night is one of the greatest events that can occur in anyone's life, and I don't want to miss this unique opportunity. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, on this day, July 25th, 7 years ago, while marking International Quds Day, members of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria were attacked by the military. Now, three of the sons of the organization's leader, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, were killed along with many of his followers. Then a year later, members of the organization were attacked again, killing at least 1,000 of them, with many others being arrested during the Zaria massacre. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife were wounded and arrested, then and still remain illegally incarcerated. The question is why. Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight.
On July 25, 2014, Nigerian soldiers attacked in an international Quds Day rally in the northern city of Zaria by opening fire at people holding a peaceful demonstration. At least 32 people were killed in the attack and many more were injured. The rally was organized by the Islamic Movement in Nigeria, led by the prominent scholar Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. Sheikh Zakzaki has been an outspoken critic of the Nigerian government and its relations with Israel. He lost three of his sons following the attack. One was shot during the rally, and the other two were arrested and later killed by the army along with other detainees. The day following the attack, three truckloads of soldiers went to the Hosseiniyah Baqiyatullah, the headquarters of the Islamic Movement, and carried out yet another assault. Nigerian soldiers raided the place and bombed the mosque. Three people were killed and dozens of others were wounded. Sheikh Zakzaki asked people to remain calm and called on the government to investigate the incident and bring those responsible to justice. But instead, another bloodbath took place. In December 2015, Nigerian soldiers attacked a religious ceremony organized by the IMN. The army claimed that they had responded to an attempt to assassinate Nigerian Chief of Army staff. The movement roundly denied such allegations. One day later, the army, using machine guns and tanks, attacked the movement's headquarters as well as the homes of members of the IMN. The extrajudicial killing left over 1,000 people dead.
They inhumanely massacred over 1,000 innocent people, among them 297 women, 23 of them pregnant.
Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife were shot and injured during the crackdown. They were taken into a custody instead of a hospital. Nigerian authorities claimed that they had detained a cleric to protect him from violence. The government later outlawed the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Many members of the IMN believe that all these attacks against their movement have been pre-planned.
Past 20 years, These people had been planning more attacks on the Islamic movement.
Since the attack, Sheikh Zakzaki has been in jail without any charge or trial. The imprisonment is despite a court ruling in 2016 ordering his release. Members of his family said that Sheikh Zakzaki's health condition continues to deteriorate in detention.
Their health continues to deteriorate as they were terribly injured during the massacre. And that has also continuously to be neglected by the government, which has led to the Sheikh having multiple strokes, and Malama could barely walk due to her ailing conditions.
Several human rights groups have expressed concern about Zakzaki's health situation and have called on the international community to intervene. They say the continued detention of the cleric and his wife without any charge violates all acceptable human rights standards. Even though there have been massive protests across Nigeria and the world calling for the release of Sheikh Zakzaki, the religious leader is still in detention. His followers, however, are not standing idly by and have vowed to continue pressing their demand for justice and the release of their leader.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, Masoud Shajara from Islamic Human Rights Commission out of Tehran, and Sohaila Ibrahim Zakzaki, daughter of Sheikh Zakzaki out of Mashhad. Thank you both for being with me. I appreciate it. I'm going to start it off with Sohaila, and I really appreciate you coming on the program. Can we start off, Sohaila, and just give us an update to what's going on, how your parents are doing, and the current legal situation that they're facing?
Thank you very much for having me. Well, the general situation with my parents at the moment is that they have been in detention over the past almost six years now, and they have been moved recently to a general prison, and they have been there for about nearly 2 years now. And their health continues to deteriorate, generally because they have some health concerns without the attack, but also because they were injured during the attack in 2015. As for the court issue, so basically when they were kept in detention from 2015 towards in December, after the case was taken to the court and Federal High Court in Nigeria decided to rule that the case was their detention was illegal and that they should be released unconditionally, the government decided not to follow that. And after about over a year from that ruling, they decided to, charge them with certain things in a different court. Now, if one were to read the charges that they were charged with in this current court thing that is going on, it's quite silly, actually. They're charged with apparently culpable murder, and apparently they instigated hundreds of people to go and kill one person. That's what they're saying. And even though they did claim all that stuff, when the court sessions were happening, they didn't bring anything substantial to the case. And so a no-case submission was filed, and now we're waiting on what the judge will do on that by the 28th of this month. Hopefully, we'll get a favorable ruling in that regard.
We're all very hopeful. Masoud, let's look at the overall situation. I mean, do you think there has been added sensitivity towards the Islamic movement in Nigeria due to their massive presence on Quds Day and condemning the Israeli regime? Because I want to go back to this day, July 25th, of course, 7 years ago, which was International Quds Day. Is there added sensitivity because of the group's support for the Palestinian effort, you think?
Absolutely. And, not just Palestinians, but also the Saudis have been actively involved, because the Sheikh has been supporting Yemenis and indeed Palestinians and everyone else who's been oppressed. Islamic movement have been very vocal against injustice, both internal in Nigeria and external. He's been critical of corruption. He's been critical of injustices that have taken place. And that has made him extremely unpopular with the government, but extremely popular with people. Islamic movement enjoys something in the region of 20 million supporters, and something in the region of 5 million, 10 million active members and 5 million supporters. And during the last 5-6 years, that support had increased. There are people saying that the only one who really cares for the people in Nigeria, who's honest, and he calls us as it is, the situation in Nigeria, is Sheikh Zakzaki. And this is not just members of movement, and this is not indeed just Muslims. Christians are actually see him as a figure which is hope for the future of Nigeria.
Okay, and well, let me get Sohaila. I wanted Sohaila to talk a little bit about the overall makeup of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, because we know that authorities have been trying to tarnish the image of the group, saying that the group is violent, dangerous. Your take on, and tell me the makeup of the group and the philosophy behind the group, according to what your father had led the group.
Yeah. So, the Islamic movement itself did start about 40 years ago, and the general set of ideas that drive the Islamic movement is primarily, basically opposing all oppression and also trying to bring forth a system that isn't, remnants of what we, basically we have a system in Nigeria that doesn't work. That doesn't work because since colonialism, and also currently we have a lot of corruption. And from the beginning of the Islamic movement, the Fonterra Declaration, which my dad delivered a speech that is titled that, which basically is the general ideology of the movement, is that we, as Muslims in that regard, since it is an Islamic movement, need to actually turn to Islam for, how to go about our lives. And ultimately, with the country at large, we have to have a system that does not, that is not like against our way of life, right? So that's the general idea of the Islamic movement. And since the start of the Islamic movement, the activities that have been carried out have been for the betterment of generally people there. And that is why there is such large amount of support. If you look at the makeup of the people in the Islamic movement, you'll find all kinds of groups of people. You'll find, academics, you'll find, students, you'll find all kinds of workers. You'll find just the most every kind of group of people you can think of in the society. You'll find them as a part of that. And you'll find the activities being much centered around the development of what we have, the situation we have, trying to better that, right? Trying to enlighten people, trying to educate people on their rights, on how we are being oppressed generally in so many ways, and what is the solution for that? That's the general activities of the Islamic movement. That's what they entail. And so all of the ideas that, all of the stuff that the government keeps spreading about the Islamic movement being violent or being terrorist, it's unfounded because, at the very least, you'd think that they would have something to base their, claims on, but there's nothing like that. There's only, if you went across the street, everywhere in Nigeria, and speak with people who are familiar with the Islamic movement, you wouldn't hear such things. So that's about it, I think.
Okay. Well, in general, Masoud, why do you think the Sheikh is still in prison? I mean, we know that his release was ordered back in from one of the courts back in 2016. What is the overall goal?
Well, the court that ordered his release against the accusation, which is actually almost exactly the same accusation as that he's being held now, was the highest court in that. And then afterwards, the government was in contempt of court. They didn't appeal the decision. As a matter of fact, the court said that his arrest is unconstitutional, and he asked the government to pay penalties to him and his wife and provide the accommodation since they destroyed his house. And the government ended up being in contempt of court, and then a lower court charges the same sort of accusation. It is unbelievable. And, this accusation that he has encouraged others to murder And there were around 200 and odd people sort of charged for acting and murdering. Every single one of them was found not guilty. No evidence was presented against them. And indeed, the courts that we have been going through, this kangaroo court, which has to come to a decision on 28, has failed to bring any witnesses forward to actually prove that Sheikh Zakzaki has done anything wrong whatsoever. And this is why we feel that now that the sort of whole episode of court hearing after court hearing, delay after delay, now the judge has to make a decision. And, you know, you were referring
why do you think he has to make a decision this time around? Why do you think he won't delay it again?
Because the prosecution has exhausted all their sort of witnesses, and they haven't proven anything whatsoever. And the lawyers for the sheikh and the muallima are now saying that this matter needs to be thrown out of the court. Rightly so, because nothing has been proven. If nothing has been proven now, if nothing was proven in 2016, as a matter of fact, the only thing was proven that he was not guilty. So really, the judge has got no option but to pass this verdict. And if he doesn't, it shows that this is really just totally a kangaroo court, and they are just trying to delay after delay when everyone knows what's going on, and indeed was proven in the court.
Well, Sahela, what about the other side of the coin? Has anyone been charged or held responsible for the killing of Islamic Movement of Nigeria members? We know both in 2016 and 2017 that they were attacked and continue to be attacked when they've been protesting. So has anyone, any of these military personnel been charged or are serving time for these crimes?
I mean, you would think so, but unfortunately not. Even the case in 2014, which is 7 years today, there's no one that has been charged or is being punished for what was done, even though at the time the government said they would look into the case and figure out what happened and punish whoever is responsible. And of course, in this case, they're not even addressing that. Not only did they ignore it, they ignore the crime of the military, they went ahead and declared the Islamic Movement a terrorist group. And so therefore, I guess, you know, consider us no longer people who have any form of rights. So yeah, that's unfortunate that nobody is being held accountable for that to this day.
What about that, Masoud? I mean, you're from the Islamic Human Rights Commission. How are they able to get away with that, committing murder in mass and not holding anyone responsible?
Mazda is astonishing. I mean, I went to Nigeria a few days after, 7 years ago, after the massacre of Al-Quds Day. And what happened, you know, I did the investigation. What happened was the demonstration was actually finished. And the tail of the demonstration was attacked at the last minutes by the military, who arrived from another part of the Nigeria, I believe Abuja, and arrived late and attacked the demonstrators and killed people, massacred them. And, you know, even bystanders, you know, there was a Christian person who actually hid in the shop trying to protect herself, and she was shot through the shutters and so forth. And you know, a beggar was killed. It was really a, you know, massacre. And, you know, the children of Sheikh Zakzaki, the three who were murdered, and the Ali, which was injured, these were arrested, and then they were shot you know, they just put the gun to their legs and shot them, shattered their bone, and put them, dropped them in a van and take him down there. It was very, very clear. and evidence and witnesses, which I interviewed and I put it on record, really was very clearly this was a murder, massacre, and using power by the military. And you know, when you go down to the sort of 2015, I'm sorry, before I say that, when that happened, some media went to Sheikh and they said, they killed three of your children. What are you going to do? Are you going to take arms? And Sheikh turned around, famously said, no, truth is the weapon we're going to use to fight, and the due process. And you know, this is a man who had, you know, who has millions of supporters, and he didn't want to take the law in his own hand.
Okay, stay with me, Masud. Stay with me. Sorry, let me get Sohaila in on this. Sohaila, what Masud just said, that the about truth will basically show itself, and I want to look at that, because with that being said, and him promoting actually the opposite of what the claims are against him, that he's violent. With the opposite of that being true, did you expect more from international humanitarian organizations or human rights organizations to get involved and to condemn what is happening and the continued imprisonment of your parents?
Well, yeah, of course we did. We still do hope that, you know, more people would actually speak about it. And it's really, it's crazy that there's not as much people speaking about it, because it's not really the most normal thing that you hear about a military in a country go and kill their own citizens. And then not just once, do it, you know, many times over, and not enough people are speaking about it and not enough people are paying attention to it, even though there are issues that are much smaller in comparison in terms of how atrocious they are, that are being addressed all the time by a lot of international bodies and things like that. So it's definitely very disappointed and very disappointing. And we did hope initially, but you know, at this point, we kind of still hope that more people would do so. But I believe that, you know, whoever was going to speak about it have already done so. And yeah, it's kind of really unfortunate that not enough people did pay attention to the issue.
Well, what about that, Masud? Why do you think that is the case? I mean, we have so many international human rights organizations that are continually condemning various governments or entities for oppression, for limiting human rights, being against democracy. Why aren't we hearing a whole lot, if anything, from these organizations?
Well, really, there's only one way to explain this, and this is the level of demonization of Muslims and Islam and Islamophobia and environment of hate that exists, which actually manifests itself in this sort of way. I mean, look, let's be very clear. The investigation of the government itself on itself, you know, it came out with the fact that there were mass graves, that they not just murdered people, they actually dumped them in mass grave. Even up to this day, many parents, many people, many loved ones are still waiting to get a closure on what happened to their loved ones, and nothing has been done. They admitted that there is mass grave. We know where the location of every single of those mass graves. In the report that we sent to international court, we highlighted all these and the name of everyone who's been massacred. And, you know, they have opened the file, still the investigation going on. But despite all that, international human rights organizations like Amnesty and so forth, only echoing what already the Nigerians accepted, which is over 350 to 400 people killed. And they don't go beyond that. They don't even go beyond the fact that they admitted that there are mass graves. What should happen to this? Why the International Human Rights Organization, why the UN, why the EU, why the international community is not asking, where are these mass graves? Let's bring a closure at least on these things. Why do we have to have a situation that someone goes through the highest court in the land, find not guilty, and then take it to another lower court? I mean, this is not just abuse of power in Nigeria. This is abuse of the principles of justice.
Master, what has to happen? What has to happen, you think, right now? What needs to happen in order to see the sheikh and his wife being released? 30 seconds.
Well, I think if they don't release, if the judge doesn't do the right thing on 28, then really there is no hope whatsoever this matter would be resolved within the Nigerian so-called due process. So we actually have to put tremendous pressure from outside. And I think what is really concern for myself and other campaigners is the health of Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife, and the condition of the prison, and the fact that we are going through a corona crisis, and the fact that they need immediate medical attention. I think first of all, we need to release them, give them the medical attention, and then we need to look at what went wrong, for not just for the sake of those who were killed and shaheed, and those who are injured and their lives destroyed, but for the future of Nigeria, because
okay.
This sort of abuse should not be sort of not addressed.
And on that note, I would love to talk to both of you a lot more. And, of course, we'll be following up. You said the 28th is the court, and, of course, we'll be continually following that here at Press TV. Thank you both for being with me on this, the anniversary of the Quds tragedy. Masoud Shajere is from the Islamic Human Rights Commission out of Tehran. Soheila Ibrahim Zakzaki, daughter of Sheikh Zakzaki, out of Mashhad. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Greetings, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to Light Upon Light. I am your host, Habib Za'atar. Would like to congratulate all the Shias around the world, for these are the days of remembering the birthday of our beloved Imam, Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam. With me today to talk about Imam Al-Hadi and a little bit about his life is my beloved brother, Sheikh Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Thank you for coming.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me. It's a great honor for me to have this opportunity to be able to talk about Imam Hadi alayhi salam.
So, Sheikh, what have you prepared for us about Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam?
Well, about the life of Imam Hadi alayhi salam, unfortunately, the life and the character of Imam Hadi alayhi salam is not so much talked about, because one reason in the history, we have so little pages about the life of Imam Hadi alayhi salam.
That goes back to the and rulers, right? That
yes, the
caused,
oppression.
Yeah.
Yes, that goes back to the circumstances where Imam Hadi alayhi salam was put in forcibly. So we don't have so much narrations from Imam Hadi alayhi salam as we have from, for example, Imam Baqir alayhi salam or Imam Sadiq salatul alayhi.
I think it was him or Imam Al-Askar alayhi salam that couldn't even say salams to the Shia on the street. When they walk in the street, the Shia, the followers, the loved ones couldn't even look at them in the street because they were afraid of torture, afraid of oppression by the Khalifa at the time.
Yes, yes. Actually, starting from Imam Jawad alayhi salam, the life of Ahlul Bayt became much more difficult, became much more limited and confined. About Imam Hadi alayhi salam, well, in the time of Imam Hadi salatul alayhi, there were several oppressive rulers. For example, Mu'taz, Mu'tasim, Muntasir, Mutawakkil. Among these rulers, the most hateful, the most spiteful, the most oppressive, and the most evil of them was Mutawakkil. And he ruled for around 18 years. Right. So he did nothing less than the most amount of oppression that he could do, the most amount of killing Shia, imprisoning them, hurting them, cutting the body parts, especially interfering the pilgrimage of the Shia. So Shia was accustomed to going on a pilgrimage to see the shrine of Imam Sayyidina Salam, especially Sayyidu Shahada Salatullah Alayhi. But Mutawakkil La'anatullah Alayhi interfered with this so much. He even
The condition of cutting one hand of the of the caravan, of each caravan.
Yes,
right?
It started by Mutawakkil, Ra'anatullah Ali. But the Shia did nothing less. They loved Sayyidu Shahada Salawatullah Ali. They loved their imams, and they would give anything that they had in order to go on a pilgrimage and see the shrine of imams and have this intimate connection with imams, alayhi salam. So Imam Hadi alayhi salam, with this kind of oppression that even Mutawakkil moved forcibly Imam alayhi salam from Medina to Samarra and kind of prisoned Imam in Samarra in a military kind of area. Samarra was that kind of a city in those times, a military kind of a city. All of the forces, army of the Mutawakkil, they were stationed there. So Imam alayhi salam was put there to have to have knowledge and information about anything that Imam does. So Mutawakkil made sure that Imam is fully under control by his thought. So Imam alayhi salam did a couple of things. One is that kind of agency that we talked about. Imam continued the agency, the organization in which several people that were appointed by Imam alayhi salam
the second matter, you could call the you can't connect with them right away. So what do? You connect with them by agencies.
Yes. So through this agency, Imam alayhi salam did the task and responsibilities that he thought they were necessary, guiding the Shia, answering questions, things that we have talked about before. The second thing is, especially teaching the Shia